even just bars of soap in months right now. And so polio is seeing right now this vaccination effort. But let's talk about the other diseases. Let's talk about the fact that in Nasser Hospital alone, the head of the pediatrics department said that 2 children per week were dying of hepatitis A, also largely due to the lack of hygiene. Let's talk about the fact that meningitis that can potentially be deadly is spreading, or this horrific skin disease called impetigo that basically is these blisters that start to form and then they pus open and ooze and bleed, and then eventually as they're healing crust up, but are horrifically itchy. And the more severe cases, children need to be hospitalized for that. And if they're not hospitalized, it can lead to, you know, potential kidney failure, which can also lead to death. Let's talk about the fact that when you're driving through Gaza and people recognize that you're a humanitarian organization, children run up to the car and gesture like this, that they want soap. A bar of soap is something that we are not able to provide to the Gazan population. The lack of hygiene and the fact that if we were able to provide Gazans with a bar of soap, studies show that that would reduce communicable diseases by about 40%, means that Gazans are suffering exponentially more now than they need to be. And very little aid is getting in. If you look at the number of humanitarian trucks that, you know, have gotten in August and July and June, it's roughly 60 to 70 total.
So if you can talk about when it comes to this polio vaccine, the kids have to get 2 doses of it. I mean, how do they come out of places where they are hiding, where they've been displaced 1, 2, 3, 8, 9 times? How do they feel safe enough to go to places where they get this polio vaccine and then have to go back? And what does it mean that Israel says it'll bomb this area, but not this today? And then tomorrow they will bomb this area, and then you can go over there with that they bombed the other day.
I mean, you know, you talk to Gazans and they really feel as if they're sort of part of this very macabre, dark, twisted game where they're just getting shuffled around trying to stay ahead of the bombing, but then, you know, still risking it. Now, when it comes specifically to the polio vaccine, there are theoretically these pauses that have been set up in specific areas. And then within those specific areas where these pauses are meant to be lasting for, you know, a day or 2 or 3 or however long it is deemed to take, there are numerous points as well as mobile points that people are able to go to actually receive the polio vaccine itself. But it is extraordinarily challenging. It is very, very difficult, even under the best of conditions, to undertake a vaccination campaign, you know, this wide and this broad. And frankly, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the doctor that I was speaking to is wrong, but, you know, he was saying that he doesn't really believe that it is going to be all that successful, and that the fact that Israel is allowing this to proceed is just a smokescreen so that it can sort of continue to push forward this narrative of, oh, but we're allowing humanitarian assistance. Look, we allowed the polio vaccine to happen, and not really address the sort of bigger picture issues when it comes to the reality that humanitarian assistance is barely trickling into Gaza, that the levels of aid that we're able to provide to the people have diminished significantly, and that the number of people in need has grown drastically, and that people are being crushed into the smaller and smaller space. I mean, the conditions there, Amy, are inhumane. People there aren't living. They're barely surviving. And there are alternative routes that Israel can provide for aid organizations to be able to get assistance to the people. I'll give you one example. So we were talking about the lack of hygiene kits and soap in the southern and central part of Gaza. Now, the southern and central part of Gaza is, for example, receiving fresh vegetables on the commercial market. What this means is that most people can't afford them, but we as aid organizations can purchase them, albeit prices are quite astronomical, and deliver fresh food parcels to the people. Now, in the north of Gaza, there is no vegetables on the commercial market, but ironically, hygiene kits are getting into the north. What we are not permitted to do is move vegetables from the south to the north where they're needed, or hygiene kits from the north to the south. And this is just one sort of example of the various different hurdles and obstacles that are deliberately being placed in our way.
Before we go, Arwa, I wanted to ask you personally about your own life experience and how it's informed what you've done from being an international reporter at CNN to founding Inara. Your mother Syrian, your father American, you grew up in places like Morocco and Turkey. Just 2 days after October 7th, you wrote a piece for New Lines magazine titled, As Gaza Braces for a Ground Invasion, the Circle of Violence Continues. You write in it, we need to understand the past, the traumas of the past, traumas that have been passed on to generation, both on the Israeli and on the Palestinian side. We need to understand those intense emotions that can embed themselves and change our DNA, paralyzing fear, the desperate need to belong, the longing for home and safety, the desire for a dignified life. We also need to understand how those emotions have been historically manipulated, twisted, and how from the start of the failings of the key power brokers, incidentally, neither Palestinian nor Israeli, have led to where we are today. Your final thoughts, Arwa Damon.
You know, I'm a big believer in the need to understand a person or even, you know, a country's emotional trajectory, because we need to understand how and why it is that people act and think a certain way if we want to alter the path that we're on. And I think obviously, you know, in my journalistic career, I tried to focus on that by storytelling and by sharing, you know, the human story that exists beyond the bombs and the bullets. And in the humanitarian space, I mean, look, I still tell a lot of stories, but I also believe that it's very important for us to do what we can for those in need, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it can also help alter the balance of their own psyche. When you see a child who has been so deeply traumatized, you look at that little kid and their eyes are deadened. That spark of life doesn't exist. But when you begin to provide them with medical and mental assistance, when you begin to support them and their family, you see that spark begin to reemerge. And I think that is something that we should not negate, and that we should really be focusing our efforts and our capacities on trying to bring. Because the more that we abandon populations, the more violent our world is going to become.
Arwa Damon, we want to thank you for being with us, award-winning journalist, founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Previously spent 18 years at CNN. She just returned from a two-week trip to Gaza. She is joining us from the capital of Ukraine, from Kyiv. Coming up, we speak to Fred Trump, Donald Trump's nephew. He says President Trump once told him as they sat in the Oval Office that disabled Americans should just die. Fred Trump has written his memoir. It's called All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got This Way. Stay with us.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right. Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right. A little darling, the smile's returning to the faces. A little darling, it seems like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun.
Stevens, also known as Yusuf Islam, singing Here Comes the Sun. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. In this next segment, we're joined by the nephew of the Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, who has endorsed Trump's Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris. Fred Trump III is the son of the former president's late older brother, Fred Trump Jr., who died of complications from alcoholism in 1981 at the age of 42. Fred Trump writes about his nephew, former President Donald Trump, in his new memoir titled All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got This Way. On page one, Fred writes, quote, "I have a name, Trump, that is extraordinarily polarizing and keeps getting more so. But there is more to my name than all that friction, and I'm ready to use it for something good, a cause near and dear to my heart, advocating for individuals with developmental disabilities. But we'll get to that in a bit," unquote. Fred Trump's son, William, suffered from severe seizures when he was born in 1999, has a rare genetic disorder that causes severe developmental and intellectual disabilities. He's now living in a group home. But at one point, when Fred Trump was lobbying his uncle Donald to replenish a medical fund for William, Donald reportedly told him, quote, "Your son doesn't recognize you. Let him die and move down to Florida." Well, Fred Trump also says President Trump once told him as they sat in the Oval Office that disabled Americans should just die. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump has referred to eugenics and the racehorse theory, suggesting he sees himself as genetically superior. Previously, Donald Trump came under fire for mocking a disabled reporter. In 2015, when he was running for president, Trump mocked Serge Kovalevsky, a reporter who suffers from a congenital condition that impairs the movement of his joints.
Written by a nice reporter. Now the poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember. He's going like, I don't remember. Maybe that's what I said. This is 14 years ago. They didn't do a retraction.
Trump is moving his hands spastically for a radio audience that can't see him as he mocks this New York Times reporter. He later said he never met Kovalevsky, but the reporter said he'd spent a lot of time with Trump while working at the Daily News and covering Trump's 1989 launch of an airline. Fred Trump's memoir also recounts how he witnessed Donald Trump using racial slurs decades ago, which Trump's spokesperson, Stephen Chung, has called, quote, fake news of the highest order. Well, to discuss all this, Fred Trump III joins us now here in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Tell us about William. Tell us about your son, when he was born, and about his life. He's now, what, 25?
25. Which makes me about 100. Thank you for asking about William. By the way, it makes me feel great to tell him. He is the most courageous and inspirational person I've ever met. As you mentioned, he was born with severe seizures as a baby in 1999. We found out, my wife Lisa is a tremendous detective. It took her 15 years of searching the internet to find out they had a genetic mutation called KCNQ2. And the first years were really tough, especially the first. He was in hospital for 7 total weeks. We didn't know what his future would be like, but it certainly came to pass what it would. William is wheelchair bound. He needs assistance with everything he does, like millions of people in this country. William's condition has given me the opportunity to, if I do have some sort of national platform, is to go out and advocate on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I don't know if I could draw any parallel with what we just heard with Arwa, but people ask, is he medically okay? William's doing fine medically. He's on very intense seizure medication still to this day. But we struggle with finding a meaningful day program for William. Many people don't realize this, but when you age out of school, you're pretty much left on your own in terms of therapies and stuff. Again, to go back to Arwa, where she brought up the point when you were able to give these kids some, they had some hope, they had some meaning put back in their lives. That's one of the things that we're trying to do give the complex disabled a reason to be part of the community and give something back, not necessarily a paying thing, but to do something that will help other people. It gives them such purpose.
Well, go back to when he was born. At the time, you were fighting with Donald to get him health care?
Yeah. In the beginning, the family was very supportive. Now, keep in mind, they never visited, and William was born in Mount Sinai Hospital on the Upper East Side. Everybody in the family, my aunts and uncles, lived within walking distance of Mount Sinai. They never visited. They really never called. But they did agree to put William on the family Trump Organization medical plan, which was very much appreciated, obviously. His expenses were out of control. But if you remember back then, Donald was in very bad financial straits. And when William finally came home after 7 total weeks of hospitalizations in 2 different hospitals, we realized from a letter that Donald's attorney sent that medical care, the insurance would be cut. And we were, in essence, also taken out of my grandfather's will, my sister Marion.
Wait a second. Trump's lawyer told you that your severely disabled infant would be cut from the Trump Organization's health care?
Right.
Yeah. Now, has Donald Trump ever met William in 25 years?
Never.
And yet you're not estranged from him. You've been to the Oval Office. You've been with Donald Trump many times.
When Donald was elected, my wife, again, Lisa, knew we would have an opportunity to advocate on this very important cause. And Lisa reached out to Ivanka, my cousin, who was in the... I don't know what her exact title was, but, you know, working in the White House. And she set up a first meeting with Ben Carson, with a group that we had been aligned with called Equally Alive. And for the next several years, we would go down periodically to meet Alex Azar,
head of HHS at the time,
head of HHS, and several other departments within the government to see if we could move things along. And I had the pleasure of being an intern for Geraldine Ferraro in 1983. So I kind of knew what the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. was about. And we found that out the hard way, that not much was accomplished in the 3+ years that we attempted to.
Can you explain what happened when Donald Trump was president? You met with Donald Trump and this organization in the Oval Office,
right.
And then they left, and you were with Donald Trump.
Yeah. So we had been—the meeting lasted longer than I thought, about 45 minutes. Donald has the attention span of about—I thought it was going to be 5 or 10 minutes. And we put forward some ideas, one of which was efficiency, prevention will lower costs for providing help to this community and give better services. The meeting ended. Everybody left, including myself, but I got a tap on the shoulder a minute later from Donald's assistant saying, your uncle would like to see you again. So he greets me with his typical, hey, pal, how's it going? And I sit down, and Alex Azar is in there. And he said, those people, the costs, they should just die. I was just thankful that the group of people were not in there to hear that. I don't know how you wrap.
Those
I keep saying
people
this.
Being the disabled
equally
people.
Alive. No, the advocates on behalf of. Fortunately, there was nobody who was disabled. I don't think he would have.
Who
was
he saying should die?
The disabled people with complex disabilities, because the costs to the government were such that. And you use the word eugenics. I have yet to use that in an interview, but yeah, I mean that's what eugenics was. You know, you don't measure up. You know, you get slammed out, and that's it.
Now, this is something that Donald Trump said to you as late as just last year. Is that right? When it came to William, when you were trying, well, explain, you were trying to get support. And why do you have to keep turning to Donald Trump to get support? Financial support.
Yeah, I understand that. My uncle Robert had passed away in 2020.
There were 5 kids in the family.
Marianne, my father, Elizabeth, Donald, and Robert. And for years, they were very, very supportive. Now, keep in mind, I won't get in. I don't think we have the time to go into the whole lawsuit issue and how actually that was my money that I was asking for. Regardless.
You're talking about with your grandfather, Fred Trump, after he died, right. Instead of dividing it in five parts, the family fortune, they cut out your father.
They
and
cut out my
that
father.
Meant you and Mary, your sister, and
right.
divided between
right.
the four of them.
Exactly. So the medical fund was set up in around 2009. Lisa and I went to Donald first because I didn't have any relationship with my aunts and uncles after the lawsuit. Donald graciously came to me and we reconciled, if you will. So, yeah, the medical fund was being depleted because Robert's widow didn't want to do it anymore. Marianne was balking at doing it. And what Marianne says, Elizabeth
Marianne
went along.
The federal judge.
Marianne, the federal
New Jersey.
Judge, right. So I went to Eric. Eric was really good with Lisa and me and sort of being the interface with William's medical fund. But it was being depleted, and we really only had Donald to go to. So Eric said, call up DJT. And I called him up on the phone, and Donald always was great at answering the call for me, even when he was president. And I said, you know, I need your help. We're running out of money in the fund. And he goes, as you said before, he doesn't recognize you. Let him die and move down to Florida. And it took me a couple of seconds to say, no, he does recognize me. And what I really wanted to say was, you've never met him before. You never asked to meet him. So how would you know? And you have to say, how could one human being say that about any other human being? Least of all, your grandnephew.
So the title of your book is All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got This Way. How did you all get this way? I mean, you're talking about outright cruelty yeah. and discrimination.
Yeah. My grandfather, Fred Sr., was a very driven guy, which is great. I mean, he created more apartment buildings in Brooklyn, second most in Queens. It wasn't a very loving family. The word love was rarely thrown around. No hugs and kisses, really. And Donald was, as I say, the obnoxious one in the family. My father was the caring, charismatic guy. Donald was the young bully, if you will. And success meant everything to my grandfather. And my father was supposed to be the golden child. He was, again, you know, young and good-looking and personable. But my dad didn't want anything to do with the family business. He tried it. He hated it. He wanted to be an airline pilot. And he became an airline pilot. And years later, I got my pilot's license also. Not because of him. I admired him for that. And my grandfather and Donald did not like that. Donald called him a glorified bus driver. And my dad, unfortunately, took to heavy drinking. And in the end, that's really what killed him.
And he died at the age of
42. Yeah, I was a sophomore in college. I remember that day like it was yesterday.
And amazingly, you flew back on the very
morning.
Kind of plane, TWA.
TWA 707 into JFK.
You know, Donald Trump was in the news once again this week because of Arlington National Cemetery employee who was being targeted and pushed because Donald Trump wanted to be there with his videographers to take a picture in the cemetery that right. isn't allowed in Section 60. Mm-hmm. This brought back memories of what he did and what a number of sources said. He did when he was president outside the cemetery in Paris, not wanting to canceling a trip to a cemetery, American cemetery, because he said the soldiers who were buried there were losers.
Right. And he didn't want to get his hair wet. Just as an aside, my father, when he was at Lehigh University, joined ROTC. He also was in the Air National Guard voluntarily. The only Trump family member to have served. I was sitting right in front of Senator McCain during the inauguration, and Lisa and Andrea and Christopher, my two older kids, were there also. When the ceremony was over, and I remember the Frank Luntz interview with Donald. In fact, I was with Frank the other day, and I really wanted to get his take on what happened that day. Anyway, when the ceremony was over, I said, kids, I want to introduce you to somebody. I don't use the word hero often. I think we have cheapened the definition of hero. We cheapened the definition of patriot. I said, this man is an American hero. And Senator McCain, after what Donald had said, I said, sir, Fred Trump, I just wanted to tell you, you're a hero. And if there was one proud moment with my kids and my wife of that inauguration, it was that.
You have endorsed Kamala Harris to be president.
Yes.
What most concerns you if your uncle Donald Trump returns to the White House as president?
We've all heard, and some of us have read, you know, Project 2025, and he will say he had nothing to do with it. And I sort of half joke, yeah, that's like him saying I had nothing to do with building Trump Tower. His hands are all over that. It's a dystopian, dangerous view of what the future might be, but it really is just going back decades to what this country could be. And I say it in the book that, you know, my family was sort of like a 50s sitcom. The 50s weren't just happy days and Laverne and Shirley. There were lots of bad things. And I believe it's in the foreword where it talks about public education. That's going to affect the disabled community in a bad way. It's going to affect minority children in a bad way. I think it will be a very dangerous time if he's reelected. And again, I believe in policy over politics, and that's why I've always been a Democrat. But so did Donald, as you know. But the Harris campaign and her positions are ones I believe in. Now, that being said, I have yet to hear anything regarding disability actions that I deem obviously important, and I will put their feet to the fire on this.
Before we go, you talk about hearing Donald Trump use the N-word decades ago, your uncle, when he got mad.
Right.
He also, with his father, sued for discriminating against people of color, African Americans, being allowed in their housing projects in Queens.
Yeah, I mean, I was there that day. I was at my grandparents' house, as I often was when I was a kid. I grew up in a Trump apartment building, no minorities, by the way. And I was kicking a soccer ball around, and I heard him just shout out twice the N-word. And I went back, and there was this white Eldorado.
This is Donald Trump.
Donald, red interior, black top, with two slash marks. And he had a roll of black electrical tape. And
we have 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's kind of a pattern where the word was disgusting, but the fact that he didn't know who did it was also disgusting. The fact, when you go back to Serge Kovalevsky, the fact that he mocked that reporter was gross. The fact that the crowd yucked it up also. So I have to wonder what's in their hearts. You know, they obviously don't have a family member who has disabilities.
Fred Trump III is the nephew of former President Donald Trump, current presidential candidate. But Fred Trump is the author of a new memoir about his family. It's titled All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got This Way. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to Intravenous on Wednesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. for music and talk radio about all things, all genders. Discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through an intersectional feminist lens, our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. Intravenous, every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC. We are CJSF 90.5.